Il-program li ser tisimaw huwa miġjub lilkom bix-xewqa tajba ta' Farsons Foundation.
This is Patricia Camilleri, welcoming you to University Matters on Campus FM. In this series, together, we shall continue to discover more about the work of the university's academics and about the many activities that will be taking place on campus over the next year. I'm truly delighted to have with me in the studio today for University Matters on Campus FM the well-known author Jim Crace, who is accompanied by Professor Ivan Kalouz, former head of the Department of English here at the University. We're going to be speaking about creative writing and creative writing programs in general, and about our own new creative writing course or program that Professor Kalouz coordinates for the Faculty of Arts. I think I should dispense today with the usual brief biographies to make space for some more conversation and discussion. However, for those of our listeners who may not already have had the pleasure of reading Jim Crace, I would just like to set the scene by quoting from a review of Harvest, Jim Crace's latest book, by a review by Boyd Tonkin, who is literary editor of The Independent. Inimitably excellent, Jim Crace stands on his own ground among living English novelists. Immune to trends, guided by his own singular style, he has sown and grown an 11-volume shelf of finely crafted, intensely atmospheric books. Each novel fashions a unique climate, landscape, and mood, a far cry from everyday realism, though nothing to do with soppy or silly fantasy. Yet each bears its maker's unmistakable brand, although critics hunt far and wide for comparisons, from Calvino to Marquez, Crace is surely the nearest talent to William Golding that our literature can boast today. So I think that really gives us an idea of where Jim Crace stands as one of our best contemporary writers in the English language.
I remember when that review came out, it was one of the very early reviews of Harvest, and I was still nervous about how it would be received. But as soon as I saw that it was written by Boyd Tonkin, I knew my luck was in, because there are cruel, revengeful, poisonous reviewers in the UK, and there are generous ones, and I think Boyd Tonkin is one of the latter. So I should take what he says with a pinch of salt.
Welcome to you both. I did not recite your long list of prizes, Jim, and awards, but before talking about creative writing in general, perhaps we could talk for a moment about your experience of winning the prestigious Wendell Campbell Prize awarded by Yale University for Harvest in March of this year. You've won many literary prizes. This is the latest. What is different about this one?
Well, it came right out of the blue for a start, because no one's heard of it. It's a very, very rich prize. I think it's the second richest literary prize in the world. But no one knows that they're even being considered until you get what I got, which was a phone call on my mobile phone asking me to phone a particular number because I would have news that benefited me. And it felt like one of those Nigerian scams. But in fact, it was just this award for a lifetime achievement, I think is what they call it. It was important to me because I had been considering giving up writing fiction. I'd had a sort of a loss of nerve about 18 months before, and there'd been some illness in the family, and various factors have made me think that at my advanced age, past retirement, I really should stop writing if it wasn't giving me any pleasure. And somehow or other, having that award kick-started me back into feeling hungry for fiction again. I think partly for puritanical reasons, and that is if someone gives you some money in order to encourage your writing, it seems wrong to take the money and not be encouraged. So the timing was perfect, but just to be a little bit pious about it, I also felt a little bit awkward, because it was such a lot of money that you really wonder why it is that two millionaires would spend their money helping established writers write more books, when in the very city that Yale is to be found is some of the poorest ghetto areas of America. And that was the pious response. However, it didn't stop me taking the check.
Well, I'm so glad that it did, and we're all very glad that it did inspire you to continue your novel writing career, which you were half thinking of not going on with. Creative writing courses. There are varying opinions about the usefulness of creative writing programs, or indeed creative writing degrees, their MAs, which abound. Obviously, very well-known examples like the UEA, mm-hmm. one which was perhaps, one of the earliest. In one article I read on the subject, the writer Rachel Kusk, writing in the Guardian newspaper last year, I think made the very valid comment that other cultural activities have been given what she referred to as shelter, painters, musicians, ballet dancers, for a long time, whilst writers have not. Writing, or the ability to write creatively, was considered somehow a gift that you had and you didn't need to be taught in an academic milieu. Do you think this attitude has changed now? Do you think that it's worth looking at writing from an academic viewpoint?
Well, there's something other than academic, isn't there? There's a workshop viewpoint. I mean, I think there's an entrenched prejudice, particularly in Britain, not quite so much in America, which wants us to believe that writing is only a gift and nothing else. The people that want us to read that are the successful writers, the ones, you know, those white, middle-aged, middle-class, Oxford and Cambridge educated young men who've made successful careers as writers. And for no toxic reasons, but just for rather obvious reasons, they want their reading public to think that they've been gifted from heaven with these wonderful voices, and no one can learn to do the same, that it has to be inspired, it has to be intuitive. And of course, to some extent, that's true. The best writers are going to have an intuitive skills that they probably developed age 3, 4, or 5. However, I mean, it's quite clear that if you want to make a sculpture out of wood, you need some artistic imagination. But you also need a hammer and a mallet. And you need to be taught how to use the hammer and the mallet. And if it applies to wooden sculptures, and also if it applies to playing the piano, I mean, it doesn't matter how inspired you are as a pianist age 3, if you don't practice and you don't get to learn the chords and you aren't shown how to pace up and down the keyboard, you're never going to be a great pianist. So there's absolutely no reason to believe that the same does not apply to all people that want to start to write. Now, my approach to creative writing classes is not that we're trying to turn people into geniuses, but that storytelling is not just something for people who do it for a living behind hard covers. Storytelling is a natural social skill, and that when people want to write down their stories, storytelling skills, then a tutor can read whatever they do, however good it is, however bad it is, and spot what the next stage is. So this is my approach to creative writing. Look at the writing of the writer on the desk, have a conversation with them, sit with them in a class and say, the next stage for you is this. You need to improve your sentences. You need to stretch your plots. You need to delve more into character. Whatever it is worth doing with everybody who presents themselves, not just the geniuses.
In fact, I was going to say, how do you define standards when delivering a workshop, when perhaps the attendees only have in common this desire to write? They're all going to be so different in such different stages and perhaps different ambitions.
Well, maybe I can use a musical analogy again, and it doesn't quite fit it, but it helps to understand. We all know when we go to a concert, when the pianist has hit the wrong key. And sometimes, of course, great musicians will do that on purpose, but essentially we all know, we are attuned to how language works. Of course, the jury's out on some things. I mean, there are fans of Finnegan's Wake, and there are people who hope never to encounter more than a paragraph of it. But essentially, there are shared practices and there are shared values which we all recognise. We recognise it when we're speaking to people in the pub or at a party or at a dinner party. We know who the good raconteurs are. We know when someone is usually a good anecdotalist, is off form. We know when we ourselves, normally stuttering people, somehow hit a great note and are wonderfully entertaining that evening. We recognize the beauty of language when it's at its most expressive.
There is rather a contrast between the rather lonely world of the writer as we picture him or her sitting in a room on their own contrasted with the idea of this rather collegiate atmosphere that you get in a creative writing program or workshop or a seminar. Somehow the two don't match.
No, that's true. I mean, actually, everyone imagines that the writing life is very romantic and interesting because they read the blurbs on the backs of novels and see that someone's a drunkard, they've been married five times, they used to work in steamers in the North Atlantic, and have also got circus skills. I mean, you know those kind of entries about writers. The truth of the matter is that a writer sits at the still centre between two worlds which are more interesting than his and hers. Now, one of those worlds, in my case, is the sounds outside my office of my wife enjoying herself, or of music, or happy things going on in the garden, or the smells of cooking. Life outside my office is much more interesting than life in it. But also there's a life on the screen, on your word processor, in which people are being murdered, marriages are breaking out, wars are breaking out, Armageddons are taking place, dystopias are occurring all over the world. And somewhere between those two interesting worlds sits the writer, entirely solitary. However, you cannot avoid, if you are serious about your writing, meeting the public and meeting readers at some point. And all that workshops do is to accelerate that meeting point. So instead of working entirely on your own and then sending me off to a publisher, having your book published, and then being pulled apart by critics and by readers and your cousins, that pulling apart, that meeting with readers, happens at an early stage. So it's inevitable there's going to be an interface between you and the readers. It might as well happen in a workshop where your readers are your friends and they're there to be generous and to help you spot some of the blemishes which is in your writing. So I'm a great believer in workshops. It feels unnatural, but only because it's coming rather soon in the process.
I rather like to... A little quote from Cuss's article, which says, "The student who comes to the workshop lonely will leave it, one hopes, ready to be alone." Good. I think there's an atmosphere, there's an element of that, I think.
That's right. And very, of course, the weird thing about the workshop is that the workshop should not, well, it ought to encourage you, it ought to fire you up so that you're hungry to be alone in your office working on things. But it also ought to rattle your cage, because... Well, I'll give you an example. I was at a week-long workshop at the Arvon Foundation, which is a very high-level teaching residence for creative writers in the United Kingdom. And there were 16 writers sitting at the table on that first evening. And I went round and I said, "Tell me about your project and whether you're happy with it." And 15 of them said their project was such and such, and they were delighted with it. It was going really well. They loved every word they'd written. And the 16th person said she hated absolutely every word she'd written and it was making her miserable. Now, who do you suppose is the millionaireess? It's the last one, Diane Setterfield. She wrote The 13th Tale. It was in the New York Times bestseller list for more than a year. The point about it was that she, by hating everything she had written, was alert to the blemishes in her work. And if you're alert to it, if you're alert to them, then you fix them. So her work went out totally edited, totally perfect, and the other people who'd fallen in love with their darlings at an early stage sent out blemished manuscripts. Of course, the effect of that is that I'm asking, and we're asking readers, to be unhappy with themselves, to hate what they're doing, to be unsettled. But that's the nature of the beast. If you don't want to be unsettled by what you're writing, if you don't want to be unnerved by it and maybe depressed by it from time to time, then don't be a writer. Pack it up. You know, no one needs your novel. Go into any bookshop. There are thousands of novels to read. You must do it because you're committed to it and because you're prepared to take the blows that it will offer to your self-confidence. But it's the one, the writer, who holds his or her nerve that makes it.
I know that you've taught courses, so you've been visiting professor of creative writing at a number of higher educational institutions in the UK and US, amongst them the University of Iowa. Well-known for its distinguished creative writing courses, University of Central England, and currently the University of Texas in Austin. What are the differences, if any, between these diverse contexts? Have you changed your opinion over the years, or have the courses changed themselves? Are attitudes different in the US, in the UK?
Well, I think that when those courses first started off, in America, it was the Writers' Workshop in Iowa, where I've taught. And in the UK, it was in the 1960s, I suppose. It was Malcolm Bradbury's UEA course at University of East Anglia. There was something rather pure about them. The course, you started off only accepting writers that could prove that they'd already achieved relatively lofty heights. And they were left alone just to write their own novels. So basically, it was providing space and a little bit of support. That's all it was. But as the appeal has proliferated, I think the effect has watered down, particularly in America. Almost every university in America will offer a creative writing master's. And all of those creative writing masters need to have staff to teach creative writing. And it seems to me to exaggerate slightly that the purpose of those creative writing master's courses is not to produce novelists, but is produce lecturers for creative writing courses. And that's what's happening. I notice in Austin, for example, that you might get a very good short story which is presented by a 22-year-old graduate as their calling card for getting on the course. And they will turn up with that short story, and then they will bring that short story to the workshop to be workshopped. Then over the 3 years on that course, they will finesse that short story so that it's a bit longer. And at the end of the course, they will present that short story to get their degree, and they'll get it. And then they'll publish that short story in one publication. And then off the back of all of that, they will get a minor teaching post in some small university in the middle of Nebraska, teaching creative writing. And 20 years down the line, and I'm not exaggerating because I've seen this again and again, you look at their CV and they have still only published that one short story. In fact, one suspects they've only ever written that one short story. Now, of course, that's not good. It provides people with comfortable livings, but I also think it sells an unachievable dream. And that is that it asks a lot of people to buy into the idea that they will become famous writers if they can get an MA. Now, my belief is that you will more likely become a famous writer if you drink straight from the fountain, if you go out and live a life, if you go out and have a few divorces, get drunk a bit, travel around, study something other than English literature, primary sources, in other words. So my belief is that there are dangers, and there's something deadening in America about the MA courses in creative writing.
You yourself, though, contradict a little bit that approach, because you have said many times that your personal life, your private life, doesn't really link in to your narrative life. So you haven't had that kind of life that is then going to be reflected in narrative. You take a different approach. You have your private life and your personal life, which you're happy with, but what goes on in your mind when you start writing is a narrative that is born from inside.
Well, that's true of a lot of the writers I've mentioned so far. I mean, it's true that the conventions at the moment are that writers in America, in the English language anyway at the moment, in the English language traditions, write in an autobiographical mode. That's just a convention. It may not be the convention in 50 years' time. But it's not the tradition. The tradition of storytelling is that we know nothing about the narrator. We know nothing about the narrator of the Icelandic sagas or the Anansi legends of Nigeria or the puppet plays of Indonesia. They're there not to write about themselves, not to hold a mirror up to their own lives, but to look at society and the communities in which they live. So my view is that actually I'm not an autobiographical writer. I'm not a conventional writer. But I'm not a modernist either. I'm a traditionalist in that I write within the oral tradition, and I write about communities, not about self. But you wouldn't want me to write about self because I've not led a life which is of much value to readers. Readers want to read about the darker experiences of humankind, and touch wood, I've had very few of those.
Well, perhaps as time is passing by, perhaps I can turn to Professor Kalous before we then perhaps return again to Jim Clace's writing. Professor Kalous, perhaps you could tell us about your new creative writing program within the Faculty of Arts, a little bit about its genesis.
Yes. Well, over the years, we've been welcoming writers to various events who come over here for perhaps a week and spend some time talking to writers, perhaps delivering a public reading, You'll remember, of course, you and I cooperated on a number of these on evenings on campus when novelists like Patricia Dunker came over and David Lodge, and all of that was very exciting and we enjoyed all of that hugely. But gradually the penny started to drop that we could perhaps work towards something that was more concerted over time and that might perhaps lead to a longer term effect. And a number of us in the faculty were recognizing the signs, so to speak. There was a great upsurge of interest in creative writing. People were showing us manuscripts, clearly wanting good feedback, clearly wanting the dialogue with writers, wanting to discuss things like how does one approach a literary agent? Is editing really that important in the publishing industry? And of course, we were saying yes to all that and helping in the best way we could. But nothing beats creating a more concerted infrastructure around this. And we knew we couldn't do it on our own. And we also could see that Jim Crace, on a previous visit, had his words and his advice, and I think we can all hear even today how inspiring he has been. All of that resonated with a lot of young writers. And we got to the stage where we were saying, well, shall we set up this creative writing program? And we said in the end, yes, let's go for it. And we realized that the best way of doing that was perhaps to invite a writer in residence for a longer period. And we were delighted that Jim Crace accepted the invitation. And he's been meeting writers, both established and young ones and emerging ones, and we've been looking at ways in which we could perhaps set this up on a stronger basis over the coming years. This will not happen overnight. It's got to be rather perhaps a prolonged process of preparation while we can do a number of good things on various fronts, but a number of exciting things are happening already with the launch in the spring of a creative writing journal that will be online and that will have the best editing values we can put in there. And this will hopefully serve as an encouragement to our writers. So lots to look forward to and lots to work on as well.
Who are the students who can attend this program? Who is it actually open to?
Well, there were, with the first workshops we ran, that was available against an open call, and that I think worked well. It's unfortunate, of course, that workshops by their very nature can only accept at any one time 8, 10, 12 people at one go. So the terrible thing is that we will disappoint more people than we will be able to make happy, so to speak. But there will be further opportunities later on.
But there have been opportunities for people to come to public events.
Oh, absolutely. There have been public readings. There have been various meetings with writers who have approached us in the past about their manuscripts. And we've tried to involve as many of them as possible. And with the journal that we shall be publishing, there will be an open call for submissions as well. So I think it's important to give everyone a sense of bounce, really, with creative writing and with what we're trying to do. And over the coming months, we'll be able to announce one or two further initiatives, I'm sure.
That's great. It has obviously been very successful so far. I mean, I've been hearing from other people that you've had very good audiences for your events.
Yes, and Jim Crace has been wonderful and inspiring with his readings and also with the advice he's been giving us on how to set up the creative writing program in strong and enduring ways.
Because obviously with the experience you have, Jim, that can be a great help to this new venture. That's wonderful.
Can I just say that before I came out to Malta, I looked at several guidebooks, and the back of all guidebooks these days, they have a list of suggested reading, what you should read about the place you're going to visit. It's nearly always the work of a local writer, someone who belongs to that country. Sadly, the advice of what you should read in the way of fiction before you come to Malta is Nicholas Montserrat's The Capitan of Malta, an English writer of some value who lived in Godsoe for a short amount of time. Now, really,
what I'd like to see a few years down the line is to go into a bookshop and open up a book about Malta and see some Maltese names on that list. Because I know from just a couple of weeks here already, 3 weeks here already, that there's some great writing in Malta, both in Maltese and in English. And really, those are the books that should be on that list, and not someone who had a long holiday here.
Yes, that's very good to hear, and I'm sure that local writers will be delighted to provide that kind of material in due course. Just going back to your writing, I mean, one of the themes that is a recurring theme, shall we say, a leitmotif of most of your books is the idea of change, really. This is one of your things, looking back and forward and seeing how change affects people. I haven't read all your books, but I have read Being Dead, and I think it would be really nice if, at the end of this program, you could read a paragraph from Being Dead, because I think it really is a paragraph that gives a really good idea of the kind of atmosphere that you produce in your book. So thank you very much.
Although it's a rather somber paragraph.
It is.
Nevertheless,
it is.
A little bit of somberness is fine on a sunny Maltese day. Yes, it's about a couple who've in late in their marriage are making love on the beach for old time's sake, as it were, and they're bludgeoned to death, a cruel act by a passing tramp, as it were. Their bodies had expired, but anyone could tell, just look at them, that Joseph and Solis were still devoted. For while his hand was touching her, curved round her shin, the couple seemed to have achieved that peace the world denies, a period of grace defying even murder. Anyone who found them there so wickedly disfigured would nevertheless be bound to see that something of their love had survived the death of cells. The corpses were surrendered to the weather and the earth, and they were still a man and wife, quietly resting, flesh on flesh, dead, but not departed yet.
And with that, thank you very, very much, Jim Crace, Professor Ivan Carlos, for coming on University Matters today.
Thank you, Trish.
You've been listening to University Matters on Campus FM. Do join me again next week. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye. Il-programm li għadkom kem smajtu kien miġjub lilkom bix-xewqa tajba ta' Farsons Foundation.